The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Rose Hagen. I'm the head of Friends Select School, which is a block away on the parkway. I have the pleasure first to invite you to turn off your cell phones and refrain from taking flash pictures, and then to introduce Donna Leone to her Philadelphia readers. I have this latter pleasure not because of my affiliation with Friends Select or with the Free Library, but because I live next door to the hands-down, unacknowledged president of the Donna Leone Fan Club, Philadelphia Division. His name is Joel Katz, and he introduced me to Donna Leone a decade ago, a conversation that significantly enriched my life. I suspect that all of the people in this room have at least four things in common. Each of us remembers that very conversation that introduced us to Donna Leone and her beautiful policeman. Each of us marks the beginning of the calendar year in March with the newest publication of a Guido Brunetti mystery. Each of us believes that Guido Brunetti is real. And each of us has a Guido Brunetti story to tell. I have two. The first takes place in Venice during a trip there several years ago. Four of us reserved a gondola, and we coerced a gondolier to take us off the tourist route toward the Questura. We arrived there, took pictures of the flag-adorned entrance, noticed the construction site at the Church of San Lorenzo across the canal, and we deflected the curious stares from policemen who were speeding off in a police launch. Sadly enough, he was not on duty. The second story is about food. I received an invitation 6 years ago to a, quote, authentic Guido Brunetti dinner, unquote, from my sister and her husband, who don't live in Philadelphia but are part of the fan club. The meal included veal and pasta with sage, prosecco, and grappa. The menu was lifted from chapter 13 of A Noble Radiance, lifted with credit to Paola Brunetti. The invitation survives, a photograph of the table and company, and the memory of an exquisite reenactment at which, sadly enough, he was not present. There are now 18 titles. And if you are lucky enough not to have read them all, you have such pleasure before you. As for those of us who are caught up on all 18, we wait impatiently each year for another glimpse by way of Donna Leone's expert rendering of a spectacular city and its moral conscience in the person of Guido Brunetti. So please join me in welcoming Donna Leone to Philadelphia.
The world is made for tall people. Thank you very much, Rose. And thank you, Andy, for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here. I want to talk about the way this book was kidnapped. In a couple of things I've written or a couple of interviews, I've said that I don't have any idea when I start writing these books what's going to happen. And that's true. I really don't. All I need usually is an image, some sort of image of a scene, and that's enough to get the book going. And once that's done, I just sort of follow along behind the book, trying to figure out what might logically follow from what has already happened. So in a sense, the experience of writing these books for me is quite similar to the experience of reading a book, in that when I begin a day's work, I don't know what's going to happen. But I have to write the book in order to find out what's going to happen in the book. With a bit of, I do exercise a bit of control over that, but I don't feel that I exercise a great deal of control. Of course, when I used to teach creative writing, I would be vociferous in insisting to the students that it was necessary to have an outline, a complete outline. Complete biography. Why are you laughing? Complete biography of every character in the book, and to plan an outline for every chapter. But I think for people who have never written a book before, to make yourself a kind of auto crib sheet is very, very useful, because it does allow you to have an idea of what you have to do that day or that week. But I've never been able to do it. What happened with this book about face, I guess it happened about 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago, whenever it was that I was writing the book, more than that, maybe 3 years ago. I started a book, and I am fascinated in really a horrible way by one of the great problems, one of the great contemporary problems of Italy, which is the problem of garbage disposal. Those of you who have read or who follow the news from or about Italy with any amount of interest know that last Christmas the streets of Naples were virtually impassable because the garbage was not connected. Collected. It was connected, but it wasn't collected for a long time, for months at a time. What the news in Italy said occasionally, and what I'm afraid the news in other countries did not say at all, is that this problem of garbage in Naples, and not only in Naples, but in the entire South, is a problem that comes and goes and comes and goes. It gets fixed and disappears, and then it starts again, and then it disappears, and then it starts again. The problem of garbage in Naples has been going on for about 15 years. And what they don't want to happen is that it get into the foreign press. And things pretty much got out of hand because it was so bad in November and December. What happened to precipitate things, or one of the things that happened to precipitate things, is that the people, the citizens of a town which was selected arbitrarily by the government to be the home for a new garbage dump, resisted. They came out on the streets and they said, "You cannot put that here." Understandably, because so much of the garbage that was going to go in there is garbage that comes down from the north. And by the north, I mean not only Lombardy and the Veneto and Piemonte, but that comes in from Germany and from Belgium, and some of it from the United States. And so the people in these small villages, who already have tremendous problems of pollution and cancer rates that just sort of catapult off the tops of the charts, opposed this. Some of them opposed the stabilization of these new garbage dumps in their neighborhoods. One thing you must understand is that the garbage disposal and collection business is absolutely in the hands of the mafia. And so anyone who gets involved in this kind of thing runs a risk of going up against the mafia. So the problem of garbage disposal in Italy is tremendously complex, because it involves all of these different entities or these different groups: angry citizens, the mafia, politicians, the police, people who want to cause trouble, the no global people, the ecological people. Finally, the garbage was, after Berlusconi's election, the garbage miraculously disappeared, certainly raising his standing in the public mind. One might well ask, how is it that soon after his election, a mafia-controlled business suddenly decided... I cannot answer that question. At any rate, I was working on a book about this garbage situation, and then I remembered that I had been invited to Zurich to attend the rehearsals for a Handel production, Handel Semele, which is either an opera or an oratorio. No one seems to know which it is. Cecilia Bartoli was singing, Bill Christie was conducting, and I went to attend the final rehearsals and then the first five performances. So I was in Zurich for about 3 weeks, and because I have a lot to do when I'm in Zurich and I know a lot of people there, I didn't work. I didn't even bother to bring a computer with me. I just went. I spent 6 hours a day listening to Handel for 3 weeks, and I was in heaven, so I couldn't work. But the night of the prima, the first performance, I was leaving the theater and chatting with a friend of mine, with the friend with whom I had gone to the performance. And as we got to the steps that would go down to the place where the coats are held, I noticed walking towards the steps, or as I was maybe 3 meters back, I noticed in front of me, but just noticed in the sense or in the manner in which one notices things that one doesn't really notice. I noticed a very slender, tallish, blonde-haired, elegantly dressed woman whom I thought was probably Swiss, just because of the elegance of her presentation and the manner of the elegance of her presentation. I looked at her, I registered that the way one would take a photo, and then I went back to talking to my friend. As I got to the top of the steps, I paused to go down, and the woman I noticed was standing next to me. I had seen her only from the back, so I had no idea of her age, although she moved with a certain elasticity, so I assumed that she was a woman in her 30s or 40s. So I turned and I looked. One second. And what I saw was the face, remember the bride of Wildenstein? Jocelyn Wildenstein, otherwise known as the Catwoman, whose face was on the cover of the New York Post. She has had, I think, at last count, I think she's had 17 facelifts. And shows the result of this. In her case, it is a desired effect. I think she has been quoted in the New York Post, not that that means anything, as saying, no, I'm quite serious. I think it's a pretty unreliable newspaper. But I live in the world of the Gazzettino, so I know about unreliable newspapers. I read the New York Times, so I know about unreliable newspapers. A parenthesis. Every article I have ever read in the New York Times about Italy has had at least one error of fact. I'm not kidding. It is absolutely unreliable in totality. There's at least one error of fact in those articles I've read about Italy. So imagine what they are telling you about other countries. Anyway, the paper had her photo, and in it, it was said that she desired this look because she wanted to make herself look like a cat. This woman looked like her. I saw her for 1 second. I got my coat. I went home, and then a week later I went back to Venice and went home. I went back to work. And as I went back to work on the book that was meant to be about garbage, there she was. This woman came into the study and would not leave me alone and would not leave the book alone. And so luckily I'd done enough of this book stuff that I knew by then that the thing to do was let her into the book. And if she chose, let her have the book. Because I do really have the sense that I'm not in control here. The book pretty much tells me what it wants to do. And this felt right, because I found her a very fascinating character because of the inability to mesh the elegance and the appearance. Then as she took flesh in the book and became more and more of a real character, the personality that she revealed was itself tremendously at odds with this face that she had created. She comes into the book in a fashion, for those of you who have read it, bear with me. She comes into the book in a fashion similar to the way she came into my awareness. That is, Brunetti was standing at a window of a bookstore with his wife, December, and he sees, he glances, he hears footsteps, and he looks up only in time to see this very elegantly dressed woman with blonde hair and good ankles, because she's wearing a long fur coat, good ankles and expensive shoes, on the arm of an elder, I don't know where he came from, of an elderly man. He watched them go up and down the bridge, and then Paola asked a question, and he returned his attention to her. When they get to the palazzo, he notices the coat, the woman's coat, is in the back of the closet. And then he sees the woman standing, but he sees her. This was the original version of the book. He sees the back of the woman. He sees the blonde hair and the ankles and the feet looking out over the Grand Canal, having a drink, and he sees the face of the elderly man and recognizes him as one of the powers that be in terms of money and connections in the city. Chat, chat, chat. He stays over here in this part of the room and he observes them, but then he's distracted. Finally, the dinner call is made. They go in, and he's walking along the table looking for his name tag. And he finds Guido Brunetti, and he looks up, and there she is, opposite him at the table. So he's seen her once, he's seen her twice, and then he sees her face. And he has the same kind of bourgeois prejudices that many people have about physical appearance. And he immediately classifies her as a bimbo. She's got to be, because she's got this face. And the face comes from repeated plastic surgery. Thus, ergo. But it really is, it becomes post hoc. As the book will later reveal to you, he assumes that she's got to be what he thinks she is. So they start chatting and they talk about the weather. And then finally, with some modesty, she says, "Excuse me, commissario, is it true that you read?" And he thinks, "Oh, I got 2 hours of this." And he says, "Yes, it is." And he doesn't ask her if she knows how to. He says, "Are you a reader?" And she says, "Yes, I am." He asks what she reads. And she says, "I read history." And he's not going to buy it, because he keeps looking at her face. And he thinks, aha, Cleopatra's fashion tips, or what is it? He will not allow himself to believe that she reads history. And he says, "Oh, really, what are you reading now?" And she gets a little flustered, ha, ha, ha. And she answers, "Cicero's Letters." But he's still not going to let her go. He's still not going to buy it, because he remembers that there's a new translation of Cicero's Letters into Italian. And he thinks she's doing what we've all done so many times we can't remember. You read the book review and then you pretend you've read the book. I used to do it when I taught university, except I taught the book. So he says, "Are you reading the na-na-na-na-na translation?" And she gets flustered. And then she says, "No, no, I'm reading them in Latin." Yeah, and he doesn't know what to do, because the two straight lines that he has created could never possibly meet, but the two lines have just banged into one another. She's another passionate reader of Roman history. And Brunetti has gone through his life reading Roman and Greek history, and he's never met another true believer. He's always been the only atheist in the foxhole. And you know what it's like when you have a passion and you can't find anyone who sees it as anything other than a sort of bizarre behavior. So they start talking. And they start talking about Ovid and Tacitus and Livy, and he finds out that she's read far more than he's read. And she's been reading it in Latin. And so they talk and they talk and they talk and they talk. And it is an indication of his enthusiasm or his rapture that he pays no attention to his dinner. He doesn't know what he's eating. He's just blah, 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 blah. So the dinner finishes and they go their separate ways. And he starts to walk home with Paola. And at a certain point, as they approach a bridge, she stops and looks at him and says, would you mind telling me what that was all about? And he doesn't know what she's talking about. He's absolutely flummoxed by the question. And he looks at her and he bleats, but she reads. And Paola thinks about that for a moment and responds, I hope you realize that you're speaking to the only person in this city who would understand what you've just said. And it's true, because she is the only person of their acquaintance who would understand how it is that to find someone who shares your passion, and it doesn't matter what it's for. In this case, it's reading the classics. But it can be for almost any, even postage stamp collecting. It really doesn't matter. When you find that person, you like them and you feel a kinship with them. And because of this kinship that he creates, or that the books create between them, as the book continues and it becomes more and more evident to Brunetti that her husband is mixed up in something that he shouldn't be mixed up in, he finds himself in a very difficult position because he has to deal with his instinctive trust of this woman because of what she reads. And what he suspects her husband's up to. About 3 weeks ago, I was in London and I had lunch with Tom Holland, the guy who wrote Rubicon and Persian Fire. Has anyone read them? Really? Oh, get out your pad where you write down book tips. Tom Holland is an English writer who studied history and classics at Cambridge, and he wrote a couple of novels, and then about 3 years ago wrote a book called Rubicon, which is a history of the fall of the Roman Republic, which is breathtaking. He makes it real. The book is as good as a novel. And then 2 years later, he wrote a book called Persian Fire, which is about the Persian invasion of Greece in the 3rd century BC. And that is equally breathtaking. He and I are going to teach a class together at a music festival this summer, so I had to meet him to talk about books. Anyway, he said, when I read, because I sent him a copy of the book, and he said, when I read that she was reading Ovid, I knew she couldn't be bad. And I laughed out loud because it was nice to have a historian, a wonderfully well-read historian, decide a moral issue on the basis of someone's reading. And you know we all do it. When you go into someone's house, you check the books. Or for those of us who are music junkies, you look at the books and then you check the CDs to see what they listen to. The things I've seen. Oh. And so the book continues, and Brunetti has to spends most of the time in the book trying to figure out how to come to terms with what for him is an emotional response, an intellectual emotional response, and try to figure out how this can possibly be. And as the book progresses, there is more and more evidence in her disfavor. But Brunetti is He's stuck with his original impression. Whether he's correct or not, I will not reveal. The books have dealt with some of the things that people ask are have to do with my increasing apparently my increasing interest in social and political issues, and I don't see the books the way readers see the books, I think, because as soon as I finish them, I delete them. I don't think about them. I don't remember them. I certainly don't reread them. In fact, I had to give someone a copy, or I had to find something in a copy of an old book last week, and I realized I don't have copies of maybe 7 or 8 of the books, because I gave them all away, because I knew that I would never... I read it. I'm not going to read it again. I'll read Cicero again, but I'm certainly not going to read that again. I do forget the books, so that when people say things like, are the books getting bleaker? Are the books getting blacker? The only answer I can give to that is kind of syllogistic. If these books are a reflection of my thoughts about Italy and my reflections upon Italy as it is changing, and they are my thoughts about Italy are getting blacker and blacker and bleaker and bleaker, then yes, the books, as reflections of my immediate, that in the day or in the time, opinion of what's going on in Italy, yeah, then the books must be getting blacker and bleaker, because my vision of the country is very often their vision of the country, and certainly my friends are getting blacker and bleaker about what's going on. In fact, about a month ago, I was at a friend's house for dinner, the woman has a daughter who's maybe 23, 24, who's studying in Spain. And she said, thank God my daughter lives in Spain. And thank God my daughter is going to continue to live in Spain. And then she said it and she went. And we were all struck at the table. We were all struck to silence, because here was la mama italiana who was saying, I'm so happy my daughter doesn't live with me. I'm so happy my daughter lives in a foreign country. But we had been talking about the situation in Spain and the situation in Italy in general, and she was merely expressing her joy that her daughter's future was in a different country, because she thought her daughter would have no future in that country, in Italy. And it is a sentiment that only Paola had ever articulated it to that degree, and was surprised herself with the articulation of the thought. But I've had other friends who have said, they've stopped short of this, of saying this, but I sense a real despair on the part of my Italian and Venetian friends that things just continue to get worse and worse and worse. And now there's the economic crisis that is added to it. And I think what is difficult for Italians is that they know that all of the numbers are cooked. The numbers about unemployment and the numbers of closed shops, lost livelihoods, and everybody is convinced that the numbers are much worse than the government admits. So what's going to happen? I have no idea. I call home almost every day, and the mood is not lightening, and the numbers aren't getting any better. If those of you who travel in Italy, one thing you will notice this summer if you go, is the increasing number of shops that have closed. You will see lots of for rent signs and for sale signs in shops, and a lot of closed shops because people simply cannot remain in business. Last week, the people from whom I've been buying cheese and milk and mineral water and various things for the last 10 years, they're closing. They just got fed up. I was there when Simone got a tax bill, and he said, that's it, I'm stopping. And he's closing. Oh, he'll be closed when I get home. And he and his wife will try to get jobs working in a supermarket, working behind the counter in a supermarket, because he said he simply cannot, with the tax situation currently in place, continue to be in business. And this is a lament that you hear. You will hear, those of you who have Italian friends or relatives, you will hear this summer if you go. Things are very. I've never known things economically to be this bad, and emotionally, I've never known things to be so bad. I've heard people say, "I'll never vote again. Never. I will never allow that to happen to me again." So where it's going to go, I don't know. And this kind of sense, of tactile sense of my friends, because I would never presume to say that I speak with any amount of authority for Italy. I speak only for what I hear in the bars and at dinner tables. I've never sensed it to be so gloomy. So I'm sure that some of that will filter into the books. I'm about to begin. I finished the next one, but I have to, when I get home, I'm going to start another book. And I have sort of an idea for it, but I have to start writing it to see if the idea is any good. Has anyone here a question? I know what I know, but I don't know what you don't know. There are microphones floating around. Yes.
Do you have any mic and microphones?
Okay. Okay, and then this woman here.
Do you? Hello. Do you have any real life models for the characters that recur in the novels?
No, there aren't any real. Brunetti and Paola are completely fictive. They have qualities of different people, but as entities, they're completely fictional characters. The only real person is the painter Lele Bortoluzzi. I had forgotten that he's my friend Bobo Ferruzzi, the painter. He's the only one in the book. And there's one other person. In one of the books, a woman looks out the window and sees a body in the canal, and she drops her espresso cup into the water. I think it's in the second book. The day that I got the copy, this is 15, 16, 17 years ago, I was invited to the home of my best friend Roberta's mother, Bianca. And I said, "Bianca, I want to read you something." And Bianca speaks Friulano dialect and Veneziano dialect in Italian. And the book was in English. I said, "Bianca, don't worry, I'm going to translate it." So I started reading it, and I translated it into Italian. And, you know, and I said, the window, to open the window. And Bianca Marcolin looked out the window. And Bianca went, "Bianca Marcolin, so me." So she's just immeasurably chuffed to be in the book. And she's the only one who has a real name. So every once in a while, when Bianca Marcolin goes into Brunetti withdrawal, she has a copy of the book, and she says, "Donna, read me the passage." So I have to read the passage to her. Bianca Marcolin, who drops the cup into the canal. And since I've known, Bianca's my second mother, I've known her. She's 88, so I've known her since she was 40-something. It gives her immeasurable delight to be in the book, but she's the only one, and all she does is drop the cup. Sorry, did you get the microphone? No, she had her hand up first, and I did call her.
I wondered, since you're talking about how bad things are getting in Venice, whether you would ever consider leaving.
No, once you live in Venice, you really can't live anywhere else. No, it would be impossible. No, if I couldn't live in a well-ordered place, because someone would expect me to obey the rules.
Own admission, in the way you write books, the style, have you ever started a book and partway through decided you did not like the direction in which it was going and then just toss it?
Yeah, I tossed one book, and I tossed it for a very good reason, for both a theoretical and a practical reason. I am of a mind that there are two things mystery writers should not do, people who have created series like this. One is move the person who is locked into a place somewhere else, because you spend your time, at least in those I've read, making cheap touristic remarks about the place you've taken your detective to. And because the only kind of remark you can make about places you don't know is cheap touristic stuff. So Brunetti stays in Venice. The other thing that I think they should avoid is passionate commitment to a theory. And I wrote a book about ecological terrorism. And I postulated an act of ecological terrorism and finished the book. And then when I reread the book, I said, nah, this doesn't go. This book really isn't very good, because the enthusiasm overcame the book. The business of the book became polemic, not telling a story. And so I just threw it away. And I hope I won't do it again. Because readers don't like to be preached at. Nobody likes to be preached at. Anybody, whoever waves their hand the most vociferously. Okay, she's waving her hand.
I have a much less lofty question for you.
Oh, good. I'm sure I have an equally unlofty answer.
In the early books, Guido always says permiso before entering a house, and he seems to have stopped doing that recently. Has this fallen out of favor in Venice?
Well, it depends on the house that you are entering. If you're entering a house where you are entering for the first time, you have to say permesso. You have to ask permission to go in. But when you've been to a house often, you don't have to say it anymore. I didn't realize that he had stopped saying it. See, I told you I don't reread the books. Thank you. I'll make them say it. Guido, shape up. Shocking.
Yes. Okay. So will Paola's parents ever pass on, leaving the palazzo to the Brunettis?
I don't know. No, I don't know. I don't know. If I knew, I'd tell you. But when people ask me what is going to happen, I don't know, because I don't have a plan, and I don't think about the books unless I'm writing the books. At a conscious level, they are almost never in my mind. There are two things that you're going to find hard to believe, because I'm here talking about the books, precious me. There are two things that I don't do. One is I don't think about them, and the other is I don't talk about them. Not for, out of any sense of secrecy or bizarreness. It is simply that I do not see how people who do not read these books, because none of my friends read these books because they are Italian or Venetian, or they are people who work for the various publishing houses who publish the books, the last thing they want to talk about is these books. And my Italian friends don't want to hear about them because they can't read them. And so I almost never talk about them. And I almost never think about them. This circumstance for me in terms of my life is absolutely artificial, because I'm doing two things I don't do. I really don't think about them. So what's going to happen in the future? Beats me. There's a man in the last row who is pounding on the head of the man in front of him. So.
Thank you. Have you given any consideration or thought of the possibility of one of the novels becoming a movie, or even worse, a TV program?
A German film company has made 16 of them into very Teutonic television programs. Two of which I have seen. Yeah. The television programs in Germany are very, very successful and are watched by lots and lots of people and are being reshown. I've never had a television, and I don't like movies. I never go to the movies. I find them excruciatingly boring. I would much rather read or go to the opera. But when I was in London 3 weeks ago, I met, because my publisher, my German publisher, who was also my agent, had received an offer from, had received offers from four different television companies in London who were interested in producing the films into television, a television series. And so we met in the course of 2 days while the agent was there in London. We met 1, 2, 3, 4 representatives of various British production companies. And the person I liked the most was a producer from BBC because she loved Dickens, and we spent an hour talking about Dickens. She's the producer of both The Bleak House and The Little Dorrit. So I said to, I told the agent, if you get an interesting offer from Kate, I have no objection to it. But I don't make the decision. My agent makes the decision. Because with the Germans and with the English, I don't have any... No, I'm lying. Something I often do. The only thing I would do is ask about the music. If and when these things are sold to some production company in England, I don't want script approval, I don't want to write the script, I don't care who acts, because I don't know who any of these actors are. I would like them to consider the possibility of using Il Complesso Barocco, which is the opera company that I'm involved with, as the producers of the background music, and I would like the background music to be Baroque music, not necessarily Handel, but certainly Baroque music, because I think it would be a very pleasant change from what I hear is the current choice of music for television programs. And if they were agree, if they were to agree, anybody who offered to do the music with Complesso Barocco, I would insist that they be given the production rights. But yeah, it's probably going to happen in the next couple of years. I'm not choosing. The ladies with the microphone are choosing. Yes?
Oh, just wait. Oh,
just wait. Do you consider yourself Italian or American?
I'll tell a story that will answer that question and leave no doubts in your mind. Some years ago, I was talking to a neighbor, an Italian neighbor, an Italian woman, who lives not far from me on a canal. On one side of the canal is her home, and on the other side of the canal is Casa di Cura for old people. She has a balcony on the third floor. They have a balcony on the second floor. So one day we were talking about this, and she said, "Oh, you, signora, you wouldn't believe what the nurses do." And she used infermieri, so one of the nurses was a man. "You wouldn't believe what the infermieri do on that balcony." I said, "Signora, I mean..." She said, "Yeah, I'm up on the third. They don't see. They're so busy, they don't see me." "Signora, are you telling me that?" And here am I, the child of, or the grandchild of two Irish women. I'm thinking, "Oh," I said, "Signora, are you telling me that this is... Obviously, you object to this. Do you see this as an offense to common decency?" And she said, no, they should be working." So I'm an American. Because if I were an Italian, it wouldn't bother me what they were doing out on that balcony. If they were doing it at lunchtime. No. That's not going to change. Yes?
Are your books translated into Italian, and how are they received?
They are not translated into Italian. Therefore, they are not received. No, Italians have read them in, some Italians have read them in English or French or Spanish or German. And when I have reason to speak to someone who's read the books, an Italian who has read the books, the only question I ask is whether what I say is true. And most of the times they say yes. Sometimes they don't like the fact that I make criticisms of Italy, which is understandable. I have tremendous respect for that sentiment, because even I, as an American who has not lived in this country for 40 years and will never live in this country again, I don't like it when non-Americans say the same thing I do. I think it's stronger. If I want to say my husband's a creep, that's one thing, but you can't say it. And I think this is a very normal human response. So when Italians are a little bit offended by some of the remarks I've made, I point out only that Italians say much worse and do say much worse. You just have to look at Gomorrah. He said infinitely more horrible things that I've said. Yes?
How did you end up
in Venice?
Divine intervention. No, I got lucky. I went there in 68 as a tourist, and I made the friendship of two young Italians who later married. And to this date, they're my best friends. I see them two or three times a week. I have dinner with them at least twice a week. Finally, I spent a long time just roaming, because I never had any interest in success or having a real job or any of that stuff. And as a professor of English literature, I could always get a job in the world. And then finally in 81, I got burnt out by teaching for 9 months in Saudi Arabia. And so I decided that it was time to settle down. So I settled down in Italy, in Venice, because by that time there were so many people that I loved and who loved, I like to think, loved me, that I moved there for completely emotional reasons, not for artistic or aesthetic. But I'm prepared to lie about that too. And, oh. But no, it was just an emotional choice.
I have a lot of questions, but I'll only ask one.
Yes.
What gave you the idea to write the Brunetti books? What led you to that down that path?
I was at an opera performance, an opera rehearsal at La Fenice, 20 years ago, more than that. Gabriele Ferro was conducting La Favorita with Shirley Verrett, who was sensational. And his wife and I and Gabriele were in the dressing room chatting about a recently deceased German conductor. And things got escalated. And one of us was talking about, well, if he were to be killed in the dressing room, how would it happen? Where would he be? And the thought came to me that this would be a very good idea for a murder mystery, which I hadn't written a murder mystery, and I had never thought about writing a murder mystery, but it seemed like an appealing idea. And I was confronted with a month's vacation between terms. And so I started writing the book, and I liked it. I enjoyed doing it, so I continued writing it. And then I finished writing it after about, I don't know, 9 months or a year. And then since I really am without ambition, I had done what I wanted to do. I had written a book. So I put it in a drawer and forgot about it until a friend of mine nagged me into sending it to a contest, which it won. And then an American publisher offered me a two-book contract. So I had to write another book. And then they offered me another two-book contract. I had to write two more books. But the whole thing, and that's why I'm so cavalier about it. I'm not pretending to be cavalier about it. This is nothing I ever longed for or strived for or was miserable because I didn't have. This just happened. And I was very, very lucky. And I see it as a great example of tremendous good luck. Yeah, someone else?
I have two questions, if I may.
Sure.
I may have forgotten over the years, but I don't remember reading a description of Brunetti.
No, there isn't.
And I was wondering how you envisioned him.
No.
And the other question is, we're lucky enough to have plans to be in Venice next month, and I was wondering if you endorsed any of the Brunetti tours.
Ah, okay. I don't know what Brunetti looks like. I think the only thing I've said is that he's sort of tall, he's sort of stocky, and he's sort of balding. And he has dark hair. There's a book called Brunetti's Venice, I believe. It's written by Tony Cepeda. Tony and I taught together for the University of Maryland for 15 years. And when my German publisher said that they wanted to produce, because they received so many requests for guidebooks for the Brunetti books, I said, I don't want to do that, because that would take me too much time, and I would rather go to the opera with that time. But I said, I know Toni, and she was already giving tours of the city, showing friends and people who were sent to her, places where things in the book happened. So I asked Toni if she would write the book, if I wrote the introduction. So she wrote the book. I read the first draft, and I read the final draft. And I think it's quite good. I think it's very good. I wrote the introduction, and she does give guided tours of the city. I think her contact information is available on the Grove Atlantic website, or in the Brunetti book. But this is something I can recommend with complete conscience. Because I've reached a time where the idea of doing something just to make a lot of money doesn't appeal to me. And for two reasons. I don't want to do it because I'd rather go to the opera. But I also think it would be dishonest to do something I wouldn't want to do and do it badly. And I just don't think that that's correct behavior. But I do have every I was correct in having every confidence in Tony's ability, both as a reader and as a writer. I can recommend the book with no hesitation. Another question? I'm not choosing.
Oh, wait, you had a question.
I wouldn't want to be the one. Yes?
Yes, with the exception of, you often talk about dining out, except for Da Fiore, which everybody loves, which other restaurants would you recommend?
Except for Da Fiore, which many people love.
I do. But which? Do you have any other favorites that we should visit?
Restaurants?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Antico Martini.
Oh, that's very good, yeah.
Which has changed hands and has a new owner. I think Antico Martini has become sensational. Testiere is very good. Alcovo is good. I ate in a place last week. I can't remember. Oh, 2 weeks ago. I can't remember its name. There's a place behind San Samuele where I've started going. Baccaretto, I think it's called. It's quite good. But usually I eat it at people. By choice, I eat it Antico Martini, just because I like it. And I know the menu. Yes, someone here. They're getting very restive over in this corner.
I think that Paolo's parents, the Palazzo's, the Falieri family,
mm-hmm.
and there are Palazzi Falieri mm-hmm. in Venice. Is
not
there?
Not where I put it, but yeah, there
right.
are.
And so I'm sort of interested in the history of those Palazzi that are Falieri.
There's a Palazzo Falieri in Canareggio, not too far from Villa. But the best thing to do is get Campi Campielli, what is it called? Calle Campi Campielli, which is a guidebook by section, by street. And in the back they have Palazzo. And you can find anything. Oh. No, I made them up. Oh, no, the Falieri family. One of them, I think there was one of the Falieri doges is the only doge who was ever executed for treason to the city.
Happy with the character resolution in About Face, but I want to know if that toxic crap is still laying in the bottom of the tanks.
Well, there's toxic crap all over. A couple of years ago, Marghera was told that it had to get rid of all of the mud around the petrochemical plant, so the mud disappeared, and everybody thought, ooh, wow. And then it was revealed in the Gazzettino that the mud turned up down in the south being sold as fertilizer. So,
we have one here.
Yes?
Since you say you don't really plan your books, but the books take you where they want to take uh-huh. you. Do you do much rewriting?
No, not a lot.
No,
what happens is by the time that I'm finished with the book, I've read every chapter, I'm sure 15 times, because I read the chapter when I'm writing it, and then I read it when I finish it, and then I read it the next day, and then I read it the next day, because usually I try to keep some sort of coherence. And then in the final editing of the book, I read it four times, the whole book four times, doing the final edit. But that doesn't mean rewriting. I sent it to an editor, a very good editor in New York and a very good editor in London, and they correct things like people have lunch twice that day or Tuesday is after Wednesday because I'm capable. But that happens after when you're dealing with 360, 380 pages of manuscript. It's very easy to forget or to mix up the days. Or if I say 3 days passed, and I've got it in my head that it was Monday, but in fact it was Saturday. I make a hash of these things. But luckily the editors are far more careful than I am. Yeah. Ah, the desire for information has suddenly disappeared.
She's going over
there. Nope, there they are.
isn't the way your characters take over your books something like the way Pirandello's took over his play?
That is, yes. I gave up teaching literature. I stopped that. I'm a recovering academic. I can't go there. Another question? Okay, two more questions. The penultimate question.
No, actually, it isn't really a question. I just want to tell. The questions I had were already answered. How you ended up in Venice, but by chance I ended up there for 3 days, and I had only read one of your books before about the Vocompra.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to say that I couldn't walk through Venice without thinking about you and that book, and seeing the people selling their purses and things like that. So
there's a lot of them.
Yes. It was very enjoyable.
And the city has vowed to clean them up and get rid of them. There's a lot of them. Okay, the last question.
Ooh, last question.
Better be a good one.
Every book has...
Okay. Oh, all right, we're going to have two last questions. Sorry.
Every book has a quote from an opera to start.
Uh-huh.
Where in the process do those opera quotes fit into your writing? Do they come in the beginning? You have that idea? Or... does the book end
then you find when I'm not listening to Handel, I'm listening to Mozart. And so very often I will follow along with the libretto. And then sometimes if I'm working on a book, I get zapped by a phrase. This gentleman here.
Yes. You talked about the continuity issues within a book. Uh-huh. And how your editors help you to make sure that the continuity is there. What about from book one to book 18, and you say you don't remember the early books. No. Do the editors help you if you do something that's discontinuous in terms of the characters?
I think what has happened is that the characters have become, I don't want to say people, but all right, if someone has read Pride and Prejudice 4 or 5 times, and we're asked to talk about something that Elizabeth Bennet would or would not do, they can do that with a certain measure of accuracy, because Austen's genius is such that you so completely understand that young woman. Or if you were to read a phrase, if there were 3 phrases, and you were asked, which of these 3 phrases was spoken by Mrs. Bennet, you would just choose the most vulgar one, and you'd know that it was she who said it. And I think this is true with Brunetti and company. Since I've written about them for so long, I don't know whether they have contradicted these things in the past, but I know that the way they feel in my imagination now, this is how they would respond currently. And a good example is the whole ecological business. Everybody in the books has become more sympathetic to the issue of the ecology and being ecologically minded over the course of the years. And so if I were to stick in the ideas of some years ago, it's not that I would remember that years ago this character did this or said that. It would be that as the character exists in my imagination now, his sensibility has been changed, has been altered to be more positively versed, or to be more positive in his stance towards ecological problems. But a lot of that is just dumb luck and a reasonably good memory. I have an emotional memory for them rather than a memory for what they have done or said. And that's that, because we have finished time. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.